Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today we visit the Marine Environmental Research Institute in Blue Hill and listen in on their Ocean Environment lecture series. The speaker is Elizabeth Grossman, an acclaimed journalist who will discuss her coverage of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill and topics related to her most recent book, Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, such as how green chemistry can design better, safer products and make for a healthier world. This program will be available on demand at mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is Dr. Susan Shaw, founder and director of the Marine Environmental Research Institute.
And tonight we have Liz Grossman, who's an award-winning freelance journalist for many prestigious publications, Scientific American, Washington Post, New York Times, Huffington Post. She is the author of several books. The latest one is Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, The Promise of Green Chemistry, and so on. And she's a science journalism fellow at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and member of the Society of Environmental Journalists and National Association of Science Writers. And she's one of the really finest writers that we have today writing about the environment. If you follow environmental writing, you will see Elizabeth Grossman is everywhere. She's writing every week. She comes out with fantastic breaking news articles, very in-depth, very reliable, very accurate. She's a fabulous science writer. I have so much respect for her. And tonight we have the pleasure of hearing her give the talk, Can Green Chemistry Prevent the Next Deepwater Horizon Oil Disaster? I give you Elizabeth Grossman.
That was an unbelievably generous introduction, and I'm completely honored to be here, and I won't tell you how obscure the prizes are I've won, but it sounds really, really nice to be a prize-winning journalist and a top journalist and all of that. I haven't felt exactly like the world's most top journalist as I've been trying to report on the Gulf oil spill, which I've been trying to pay attention to since it first began, because as some of you may have an inkling, the information on an event like this is very, very tightly controlled. So one spends a lot of time listening to press briefings and trying desperately to get your question in on the queue ahead of the people from CNN and The Washington Post and Fox News and The Wall Street Journal. And it's been a real challenge, which is why I decided if I was going to try and see anything firsthand and trying to get a version of events that was not channeled through press releases, I had to go down and see for myself. I'm really, really honored to be here at Mary and speaking in Maine for a number of reasons. I spent several childhood summers at a rather rustic summer camp on Oars Island in Casco Bay, and there were no electric lights and no running water except in a few select locations. And I sometimes think that it was that kind of experience that got me really interested in finding out more about the natural world. And then I was lucky enough to get to spend some time in Maine when I was working on my first book, which was about dam removal, and the first chapter was about the Kennebec River and the Machias River, so I got to explore some of that. And I've had the privilege of being at the College of the Atlantic a couple of times. And while I was working on my last book, High Tech Trash, I became extremely impressed with what was happening in Maine as your state legislators and other policymakers were working really, really hard, kind of leading the charge, trying to keep harmful synthetic chemicals out of consumer products and out of the local environment. So it's a real honor to be here. I realize I've given this talk a very ambitious title, and it's something that I've actually been thinking about, the whole idea of green chemistry and this oil spill and what the potential is for changing the whole landscape of how we make new materials, how we put them into products, how we think about their safety, and how essentially we go about preventing pollution. And this absolutely horrific example of a polluting event is unfolding in all its hideous detail in front of our eyes. This idea, particularly when I first heard the announcement about the use of chemical dispersants, I started thinking more and more about the idea of what green chemistry could bring to a situation like this. So what I thought I would do is kind of weave various observations I've been having about the oil spill situation into explaining what I set out to do in this book, what inspired me to do it, and some of the really striking things I learned along the way. But I thought I'd also tell you just a little bit about what I've been reporting on from the Gulf. The angle I've been looking at this through is environmental health, public health, occupational health, for the most part, looking at effects to the folks who are working on the cleanup and the containment. How is the environment that they're now being exposed to, how is that affecting their health? And it's been an enormous challenge to get at that information. The information we have so far from federal agencies has enormous gaps in it, and I don't think really gives us an accurate picture of what's happening. One of the real challenges is what happens when you have to rely on a corporation that has a vested interest in the information of relying on their laboratories and what comes out of it. So it's very much of a challenge, and it raises all sorts of questions that actually are questions I addressed in this book about what we know about the materials we use, what we know about synthetic chemicals. And one of the things I thought I should do right off the bat is explain something that I used as the epigraph for the book, which comes from a book that set out the whole field of green chemistry. It's by John Warner and Paul Anastas, and I use this as the epigraph for Chasing Molecules. And it says, in virtually every aspect in society, it has long been acknowledged that preventing a problem is superior to trying to solve it once it has been created. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with green chemistry at all, but that is really the fundamental principle of what green chemistry is. The idea that the best and most effective way of preventing chemical pollution and, by extension, any of the adverse health impacts, environmental impacts that would come with it, is to do it at the design stage, not at the end of the pipe, to do it before these things have entered the environment. And this sounds like it should be complete common sense, but in fact it represents a truly radical departure from how chemistry has been practiced traditionally. And the chemical dispersants that Susan had the grim experience of seeing how what they're doing to the water column in the water, that is a wonderful illustration, a horrible example of what happens when you don't think about pollution prevention at the design stage and focus solely on what's going to happen when you use a product. And what I also thought I'd do to give you a sense of why I think green chemistry is so compelling, I thought I would start off in a little bit by reading a few pages from the very beginning of the book, as I think that will help set the stage for what I set out to explore. Because one of the things I thought I really needed to do was to show what the problems are that we're trying to solve and the real challenges we're now facing, since we now know so much more about how synthetic chemicals behave once they enter the environment, once they enter human bodies. And also, we know so much more about where they're coming from, what their sources are, than we did 20 or 30 years ago, particularly back in the 60s and 1970s, when so many of our environmental laws first went into effect. And one of the things I really came away from this whole experience of writing the book, which doesn't ever seem to stop because I keep learning more things related to it, is that I am completely convinced now that the future of environmental and public health, and that is human health, really depends on our making some really significant changes in the materials we use and how we assess their safety. And I realize for most people, that may not sound like a really urgent call to action, and it certainly doesn't sound like a really enticing, glamorous, sort of sexy endeavor to set out on. But I actually think it's both, because as one scientist, environmental health scientist, working in this field said to me kind of early on, what she said was, if we wait for the human data to come out like the animal data, we won't be breeding as a species. And that's how completely profound the effects of so many of these chemicals are, including some of the chemicals that are now awash in the Gulf of Mexico. But before I dive into the opening pages of the book, I thought I should probably also explain something about the book's title. Chasing Molecules was suggested to me as a title by my publisher, and it comes from a phrase that is early on in the book when I realized that while working on the book, I had spent much of about 18 months literally chasing molecules around the world, going out into the field with scientists who were doing the kind of work that Susan and some of the other, many of the other scientists that Mary works with are doing, going out into field to see where these environmentally mobile, persistent, and pervasive pollutants are going. I was lucky enough to, and that's where a lot of these pictures come from, to go on a couple of international polar year expeditions. A lot of the funding and a lot of the research on those expeditions is focused at climate change, but because almost anything that is released in the northern hemisphere into air or water, if it lasts long enough, it eventually moves north. And so the northern polar region has become both a sink and now, as temperatures change, also a source of contaminants. And I was lucky enough to go along to see some of that. I also went to some far less sort of beautiful places. I went up to the very badly air-polluted region along the U.S.-Canada border on the Great Lakes around Windsor, Ontario, and Detroit, and up into Canada's called Chemical Alley around the city of Sarnia on Lake Huron. Like Susan, I did go to southern China around the Pearl River Delta, where so much of the world's manufacturing takes place. And I also visited a number of communities that are being affected by this kind of pollution, either because they are fence line communities or because they have the great misfortune to be located where a lot of these kind of chemicals were just literally discarded. And I also traveled really extensively to talk to as many of the scientists who were working both on the problem side of the equation, looking to see where these contaminants are going and what their effects are, and also those who are working to solve these problems in the field of green chemistry. Because I thought that it would be hard to understand exactly what green chemistry is trying to solve if you didn't really understand the nature of the problem. And our knowledge of the environmental and health effects of these kind of chemicals has been evolving so rapidly just in the time that I've been working on this book. Practically every day there's a new study that comes out, and they just keep piling up. And before I got to Chasing Molecules, I had several other thoughts for titles, and these again loop back to the whole story of the petrochemicals that form the great basis of so many of our materials. One of the things that I wanted to be able to understand in this book was how and why we had come to use so many materials that have what turn out to be so many adverse environmental and health effects. So I went back and spent a little time looking at industry archives. I was lucky enough to spend several days at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia. And if any of you are in Philadelphia and interested in the history of science, it's an amazing place, and they have a wonderful museum. And I also spent a few days at the Hagley Library, which is the DuPont Archive outside of Wilmington, Delaware. And from that, I came away realizing that back in the 1920s and 30s and then 40s, but particularly in the 1920s and 30s, when materials like polyvinyl chloride were first invented and some of the early synthetics, what scientists and engineers had done was they had reinvented the material future. They had redesigned our future. They had been working on trying to make synthetics out of things like corn and wood and milk. And all of a sudden, the petroleum industry literally exploded, and there were all of these available hydrocarbons, these molecules that were really useful for manipulating and making stretchy waterproof surfaces and eventually making into shatterproof lightweight polymers and plastics that could perform all sorts of amazing functions. So I thought I might call the book Redesigning the Future, because I realized that if we were going to solve these problems holistically, rather than just moving from one bad chemical dispersant to another, as it seems we're in the process of doing and trying to clean up the Gulf, we would have to look at this problem from a very big systemic point of view and redesign the future all over again. But I was told that if you have future in your title, you get shelved with science fiction, and that's not really where you want to be as a science writer. So I thought again, and I thought maybe I'll call the book Material Consequences, because materials matter so profoundly. Just look what our dependence on oil is bringing us. And that got ruled out as being a little vague. So I thought again, and then I came up with a title that I thought really, really would have the best shot at getting me on the Stephen Colbert Show or the Jon Stewart Show. And it was something that was inspired by a comment that the biologist Theo Kolbern made at a conference I was at a couple of years ago. And are any of you familiar with Theo Kolbern's work? Do you know her name? A few hands. She's a truly pioneering biologist in the field of endocrine disruptors and endocrine disrupting chemicals. And I'm guessing that a number of you have heard of them, but I'll just give a quick overview of what those are. But she's now in her 80s, and she's had a really groundbreaking career. And she's the co-author of a book that's called Our Stolen Future, and it was published in 1996, I think. And I recommend it. Couldn't recommend it more highly, because even though it was published in 1996, it's completely pertinent today. And if you happen to go to a talk where somebody is trying to describe how people became aware of these kind of chemicals and how people became aware of synthetic chemical pollution, there is inevitably a slide that on one side will have the cover of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's landmark book, and on the other side of the slide is Our Stolen Future, because it was truly instrumental in bringing endocrine disruptors to sort of a wider public audience. And just quickly what they are, because they figure largely in what we're grappling with now. These are synthetic chemicals, and by synthetic chemicals, I mean things that do not exist on their own in nature, and we wouldn't have them unless someone had invented them in a laboratory. Endocrine disruptors are chemicals, because of their size and shape and chemical composition, have the ability to behave like, mimic, and therefore disrupt or interrupt how a body's natural endocrine hormones behave. And as many of you may know, these are the hormones that regulate a whole host of absolutely vital bodily systems: metabolism, reproduction, immune system functions are related to them. It turns out cardiovascular systems are, neurological functions related. They're absolutely vital. So I was at a conference just when I started working on this book, and it was a small session, and we were being presented with new information about these chemicals, and we were hearing about reproductive issues, how some endocrine-disrupting hormones can reduce sperm count and affect fertility. We'd heard about how some chemicals can prompt the production of larger and more fat cells and lead to lay the groundwork for obesity and diabetes. And then we heard some research that I hadn't heard about at all before, was from a researcher at the University of Massachusetts named Tom Zeller and another at the University of Rochester School of Medicine named Bernard Weiss. And they were talking about the effect of endocrine disruptors on brain health. And it turns out endocrine hormones are necessary for healthy brain function throughout life. It's very well known and documented that endocrine hormones are really, really crucial at early stages of life, and if you interrupt them at very early stages of development, they can lay the groundwork for health effects that can last for that person's entire life and sometimes even be passed to subsequent generations. But this research had showed that endocrine hormones are vital for healthy brain function into old age, and this was absolutely brand new. And so we'd heard about lowered sperm count and obesity and brain health. And all of a sudden, Thea Colburn is she's in her early 80s now, and she's a very feisty, wiry lady from Colorado, and all of a sudden she let out this little whoop of a laugh and said, you guys are going to be fat, stupid, and impotent. And I thought, well, there was my title, Fat, Stupid, and Impotent, The Future Without Green Chemistry. And I'm delighted that you're all laughing, but only a couple of the assistants in the publisher's office laughed, so we ended up with Chasing Molecules. And I think I will, now that I have your attention, I will read a little bit from the very beginning of the book. But one of the things I really, really want to emphasize, because it does link to what I've been thinking about in relation to the Gulf oil spill, is the changing landscape that we are now dealing with. In the past 10 years or so, maybe a little bit longer, our knowledge of how chemicals behave in the environment and what their sources are and how they behave in living cells and in living organisms has changed tremendously. Once the field of endocrine disrupting chemicals got going, we began to learn that contrary to traditional toxicology, which has historically assumed that the larger the level of exposure, the higher the dose, the greater the effect would be. Endocrine disrupting chemicals, it turns out, can have very, very profound effects at very low doses and very low levels of exposure. And sometimes they may have no effect whatsoever at a high level of exposure. So we're now dealing with low-dose exposures that have profound effects, not just very high levels of exposure. We also now know that timing of exposure is really critical, and that particularly for a developing creature, baby, animal, if they're exposed to a certain chemical at a particular stage of development, the chemical can interact with very specific pieces of genetic material and set the stage for these very profound effects that can last through a lifetime. We also know that in addition to the traditional big sources of pollution, exploding oil wells, smokestacks, drain pipes, landfills, these synthetic chemicals are now emerging from finished products in their intended uses. They can creep out of plastics. They are coming out of upholstery. They are coming out of personal care products. So instead of having to face pollution prevention through the idea of putting a scrubber on a smokestack, doing a better filter on a drain pipe, we're now faced with lots of very small point sources. And I started thinking of a picture of a map where if you were trying to control pollution in 1970s style, you'd think of a community that might have a factory here, might have an outfall drain pipe another place, might have a landfill. And you could think about what you would do with the end of those pipes. Now, in addition to that, we have hundreds, thousands, millions of tiny little point sources all over the place. And you can't put a scrubber on a piece of plastic that's in a water bottle or in a piece of electronics or in a piece of carpet backing or upholstery foam or in the textiles that you're wearing. So we really have to think about preventing this pollution all the way upstream and think about dealing with it in a way that will not make us repeat these cycles. And I'll get a little bit to how I think we need to do that. And I want to make sure I don't rustle more papers. Is the mic doing okay now? Well, this is just a little scene setting from the very beginning of the book. It is late September 2008, and I'm standing in the lobby of a Manila hotel where I'm attending a meeting about occupational health, safety, and environmental issues for workers throughout Asia. On a television screen nearby, polar bears are diving off a small ice floe. Later in the day, I visit the National Museum of the Philippines, where we tour an exhibit of prize winners in a 2007 Filipino art competition. One of the paintings shows a woman clad in a dress constructed of images of cars and smokestacks. She has her hands over her eyes in a gesture of despair and is up to her hips in water. In this tropical island nation, merely 15 degrees north of the equator, where many people live on the water's edge, disappearing polar bear habitat, a sign of global warming and harbinger of rising sea levels, has local relevance. Over the next several days, I meet people who work in factories that make clothing, electronics, machinery, and other products. When asked to name their top concerns about their working conditions, leading the list are the impacts of chemicals to reproductive health and the health of future generations. When asked what they would do to improve workplace safety, all say, remove the chemical hazard, substitute something safer. And this is, in essence, the story this book explores. Over the past century, our reliance on petroleum and coal has made available a vast quantity of hydrocarbons. These byproducts of fuel refining have become the foundation for the overwhelming majority of our synthetic materials, manufactured substances that go into everything from computers to cosmetics. We've created tens of thousands of such new materials, substances that exist nowhere in nature. They have made possible the creation of countless useful and often ingenious products, the lightweight, shatterproof, flame-resistant plastics used in electronics, aircraft, sports gear, and motor vehicles, waterproof coatings for textiles, flexible plastics that go into medical tubing and children's toys, non-stick surfaces for food packaging, thin films that enable microchip etching, and polymers delicate enough to coat an eyelash, to name but a few. It's hard to imagine life without them. These materials were designed to make life easier, more efficient, and in many cases safer, and many do. But many of these substances also behave in ways that make them hazardous to human health and the environment. A number of these synthetic chemicals, scientists are discovering, are capable of interfering with the biological mechanisms that determine the health of any living organism. These materials, it turns out, have been changing the world's chemistry, in some instances altering the most fundamental building blocks of life on Earth. As a result, the entire chemistry of the planet, from the cellular level to entire ecosystems, is now different than at any other time in history. This story is a sobering one, yet what I learned while working on this book, and even more, the people I met, inspire me to think that the problems created by our past century's choice of materials are not insoluble. As with climate change, it's not possible to turn back the clock and erase all of the damage caused. However, if we build on the efforts now underway to create alternative materials that are safe for human health and the environment, and if we can prevent further pollution by existing harmful substances, great improvement and much recovery are possible. Where toxic contaminants have been taken out of use, through voluntary efforts or more often when regulations are established and enforced, affected populations and individuals, if sufficiently healthy and resilient, can and often do recover. But we have to act swiftly. As Paul Anastas, who's been director of the Center for Green Chemistry and Green Engineering at Yale University, and he's now at the EPA, and a founder of the Green Chemistry Movement, has said succinctly, we don't have a decade to blow. And I finished writing this, almost a year ago, because that's how long it takes a book to come out. And watching, I think that's partly why I've gotten so, I will say, kind of obsessed with paying attention to what's happening in the Gulf, because in so many places and with so many species, we had been working, not 100% successfully to be sure, but we had been steadily trying to reclaim some of the damage and set aside some refuges, and to see that by relying on what turns out to be very, very poor planning and thinking that you could capture a pollution disaster with the flip of a switch, so much of what we'd been doing to try and reclaim an endangered species or a threatened species like sea turtles or brown pelicans, or reclaim those communities that were already having such a hard time because of the chemical industry's effluent and what's coming down the Gulf of Mississippi, the Mississippi into the Gulf, and what it's doing to the shoreline and the aquatic life that everybody depends on. I think that's why, one of the reasons why I've just become so absorbed in trying to pay attention to what's unfolding there, and why I have feel like I want to join some of the green chemists I've met on what is essentially a mission to try and rearrange how we go about making materials, as I said, and how we go about assessing their safety. And the whole premise of green chemistry, which is to prevent pollution at the design stage all the way upstream, not introduce hazard like heavy metals, like these hydrocarbon molecules that behave in ways that interrupt vital bodily functions and cellular development, do that at the design stage rather than trying to put a cap on these things, give people better protective equipment. Just don't put them there in the first place. Think about making materials that are environmentally compatible and benign at every stage of that product's life. And this seems like absolute common sense to those of us who are not professional synthetic chemists, but one of the really surprising things I learned while working on this book was that to this day, if you get a PhD in chemistry and you set off on a career of being a commercial, synthetic, professional, organic chemist, you go off to a laboratory to make molecules, you never have to take a course in toxicology or ecology or any kind of environmental health science that would train you to look for those hazards. And John Warner, who with Paul Anastas is considered one of the founders of green chemistry, and I actually have a little sketch in the book because I wove the stories of what I came to think of as the charismatic megafauna of green chemistry throughout the book. Just kind of coincidentally, all happened to be from New England. A number of them happened to be from New England. Both Paul Anastas and John Warner grew up outside of Boston, kind of in the Lowell and Woburn kind of area. And one of the things that John Warner said to me was that somewhere along the line in his very successful career as a synthetic chemist, he had synthesized over 2,500 different molecules. He has patents named after him. All of a sudden, he realized he was completely expert in making new molecules, making new materials, having them perform these amazing functions, but he had no idea what made a molecule toxic. And he realized there was something really wrong with that equation. So it would be enormous change of direction if people who are making materials did not only consider their performance. It would go a long way towards changing what we're now dealing with in the Gulf, where we have now used over 1 million gallons of chemical dispersants that, as you've heard from Susan, are actually making the problem worse. And these chemicals, if you look at their list of ingredients, if you can find them, because one of the things we're also dealing with are laws that we have to regulate how chemicals are used commercially that put a real premium on confidential business information. And so even the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has to go through all sorts of hoops and very complicated legal maneuvers to get a company to tell you what is in their product. And if instead of saying the first thing that a new material should do is simply perform a function or complete a task like dispersing oil, you also had to consider how it would behave environmentally, what its impacts are on human health, that was considered part of a material's performance, that would be an enormous difference. You couldn't make a new deck coating if it was also hazardous to aquatic life. You couldn't make a new polymer that was going to make food containers if it turns out that was a mobile substance that would build up in fat tissue, because that just would not be a successful product. And that seems really like common sense to those of us who are not chemists, but that's one of the things that green chemistry is working to try and do, both in education and with actual products. And there are actual successful green chemistry products out on the market, but it's getting to where we need to be so that we are not reliant on hazardous chemical dispersants and other hazardous products is going to require not just science, but also policy. And that's one of the things that I found really interesting was how science, these scientists are becoming really outspoken advocates of green chemistry in order to get it into policy. And that is just starting to happen. There are a number of states that are incorporating that into various bits of state research and development and economic policy. It's being incorporated into what the EPA is trying to do in protecting the environment from certain hazardous chemicals. And it's also starting to be incorporated into medical considerations. And one of the things that got me really interested in this in the first place was when I was learning about the electronics industry, and I started finding out that chemicals that were making plastics flame retardant, or that were also the same chemicals that were used in upholstery and in textiles, that these chemicals were ending up in seals and in salmon and in fish-eating, sea-going birds, and were ending up in virtually every person that's been tested, and that the plastics that the chemicals that make the plastics that cover wires, the plasticizers that go into PVC, that these were turning up in virtually everybody that's been tested. The chemicals that make up polycarbonates, the chemicals that go into etching microchips, but are also the same chemicals that make waterproof coatings for the rain jackets that we all wear, and that coat frying pans and make up Teflon, and that also coat food papers, that these kind of chemicals were ending up in sea turtles, and they're ending up in newborn babies. And I wanted to know how and why that was happening, and if we could do a better job with all of this. And I don't think green chemistry is a magic wand. It's not going to solve anything instantly, but I think it would go a long way towards changing how we look at what we're putting in the water and look at what we're bringing home and exposing ourselves to, and could really help change the equation of our endless reliance on hydrocarbon chemistry and petrochemicals. And I think what I'll do, so we have plenty of time for questions, and then I can probably tell you a few more things about what I've been learning about what's happening in the Gulf. I think I will just end up by reading one little section from the end of the book and let you ask questions, because that's always my favorite part of the talk, because people do have so many questions about this, and there are so many things we don't yet know, and so many ways that I think the questions that people like you have are really helping to move this along. And I can't remember the exact wording of the whole lecture series that involves hope, but one of the things that was really, really conscious in my writing when I was working on this book is the fact that this is really sobering information. This is pretty grim, but I truly don't think it's insoluble. And so much has actually changed in just the couple of years that I was working on this book. When I first started working on the book, nobody knew the chemical name bisphenol A. Nobody had heard of it. Now, how many people here have heard of it? Yeah, all the hands. Well, everybody knows about bisphenol A. When I first started working on this book, almost nobody had heard about brominated flame retardants. Now, you can practically not open a newspaper without finding that some community has done a study about them, and I think Maine is one of the many states that is trying to keep them out of products. So a lot is happening, and a lot is actually shifting, because people who are interested in this and concerned about this are starting to, I don't think we can shop our way out of this, but they're bringing their concerns to the people who bring them products and make them products, and to their elected officials and policymakers, and things are slowly but surely starting to change. And I think one of the really impressive things that's happened just in the past year is that information about these kind of chemicals and their effect on human health is starting to be taken very seriously by the established medical community. It was just last June of 2009, the Endocrine Society, which apparently is one of the older scientific societies in the United States, scientists who study endocrine system hormones, they produced a scientific statement that said, based on what we know now about how endocrine-disrupting chemicals work, they were advocating policy and actually going to be actively campaigning for policies and new laws that would reduce people's exposure to these chemicals, particularly for young children and others who would be particularly vulnerable. And then in November of 2009, the American Medical Association adopted the same statement, which seems to me pretty impressive. And just a few weeks ago in May, there's something called the President's Cancer Panel, which released a new report. They do this once every couple of years, and it's 240 pages long, but does make for some very impressive reading. And their focus was chemicals in the environment and the effect of environmental contaminants on human health and how that relates to cancer risk. And that report comes out very, very strongly saying we must reduce our exposure to any number of these chemicals. It's very hard to prove direct cause and effect because we're exposed to many chemicals at the same time, and many of these chemicals have a very long time before they produce an effect, and that's one of the big concerns for workers on the cleanup in the Gulf, the way it was for workers in the World Trade Center, that there may be immediate effects, and those were some of the things that people paid attention to initially when they began to realize that synthetic chemicals were harmful to human health, but we now know that a number of these effects can take years to show up. And so if you're really going to protect people from them, you have to do so in a much more precautionary way than you would do something that would just happen immediately. So there's an awful lot of stuff happening all at once in this area. And I think one of the things we're seeing with the response to what's going on in the Gulf is, one, responding to this ever-unfolding situation that apparently nobody says they could possibly have foreseen that this would have happened, but trying to deal with things in a way that we haven't before, because part of the difficulty of responding is, yes, you want to immediately protect people, and also doing so with the knowledge that there are going to be these long-term effects that we're not sure exactly at this point how to protect people from. So I'm just going to read just a couple pages from the end of the book and then let you ask questions. More than 40 years ago, Rachel Carson warned of a silent spring. 20 years ago, Bill McKibben wrote of the human alteration of every aspect of the natural world. Nature has not ended, but signs of severe and subtle disturbance are everywhere. Scientists are now watching natural systems and cellular feedback loops that have evolved over millennia begin to falter in response to chemical wrenches we've introduced into the global environment. The materials we've used for the past century have served us well in many ways, but we could no longer afford, if we ever could, to proceed with designs that serve but one generation. In economically difficult times, when thousands of jobs are being lost and covering basic living costs is difficult for many people, thinking about safer, greener materials, products that often carry a higher price tag, can seem like a luxury. It's hard to think about parts per billion or million of a tasteless, odorless, invisible substance that may or may not interact with your equally invisible genes and hormones when you're worried about paying the rent and feeding your children. But we can't afford not to make these changes. The consequences are too great. We need to find ways to make such products the norm rather than the exception. Green chemists caution against driving out the good in pursuit of the perfect and staunchly support any steps in their direction. Yet if we were to imagine the ideal, chemical hazard-free products would not be luxuries, nor would they require special diligence and education to find. They would simply be a given. Green chemistry alone cannot bring about these changes, but I think we cannot do this without green chemistry. And so I think I'll stop there, because I could talk about this stuff for weeks, but I'll stop there and let you ask questions. So thank you for listening. So, any questions?
Hi, my name's Eric Da Silva, and I'm from Orono. And I, like probably most or many people in the audience, we try to practice a lot of green living techniques, recycling and reducing waste and purchasing green products. But this your talk certainly reawoke this great concern in everything. Like, I'm wearing a fleece jacket, and I'm drinking water that passed through a water purifier, which is made of plastic. And I'm wondering, as you wrote your book, how you change your lifestyle, and as you gain and build your education on this topic, how you are continuing to change your lifestyle.
That, as you might suspect, I'm an absolute menace to go to the grocery store with. And even worse, you don't want to get me in the shampoo or detergent aisle. I was already rather fanatic about reading labels, but now I look at them in a whole new light. Nothing's perfect, and I'm not sure there's a perfect product out there, and the question you ask is one that I asked of many of the researchers I interviewed, particularly when I was writing magazine articles or newspaper articles along the way, because editors always want to say, our readers are going to want to know what you can do or news you can use kind of thing. So I asked a lot of the folks who were doing the environmental health research, and a lot of people who are doing endocrine hormone research also happen to have OBGYN or pediatric practices. And I said, what do you tell your patients? What do you advise people to do? And all of them said a version of the same thing, which was to be strategic, to make choices that were going to have the most impact for your life, for your household. If you're pregnant, thinking of becoming pregnant, if you have small children at home, you're feeding a baby, you're going to make one set of choices that you might not make otherwise. I don't have children, crawling around a carpet, so I'm not going to be quite as concerned about taking up a carpet so that they might, so children won't be exposed to the backings of it. But everybody sort of said, be strategic. Food contact. Every single scientist I talked to, don't put plastics in the microwave. Don't put hot food in plastic. And we've all heard about polycarbonate plastics and bisphenol A now, and how heat and acid and over time, those molecules which make these really strong, unbelievably useful polymers, they also, the bonds tend to break. And so those little bits of bisphenol A get out, and they get into food, and they get into water, and they get into us and start doing things that we'd kind of rather not have them do. But everybody said, don't put hot food in plastic. I started looking around the house and thinking, oh, my gosh, I was using this nice little plastic coffee cone, one of those nice little red Melita things. Well, I have a ceramic one now. I just felt really, really guilty about I recycled the really funky-looking old water bottles that had started turning yellow, those really old Nalgene bottles. Those I just recycled. But I had all these plastic coffee mugs that I picked up along the way, those thermal things. And I felt really guilty, but I took them to Goodwill. And I'm feeling a little guilty, but I just couldn't throw out something that was actually useful. I'm from the Northeast, so maybe I have sort of Yankee, sort of thrifty in me. So, yeah, I've become pretty fanatic about that. And I was just, actually, it was Tuesday. I was really lucky and got to spend the day at the laboratory and education facility that John Warner and his wife, Amy Cannon, have set up there in Wilmington, Massachusetts, outside of Boston, in the Merrimack Valley. And we were talking about this. I mean, what do you do with the labels? I mean, I'm sitting with Amy Cannon, who has the first PhD in green chemistry and knows exactly how you make non-toxic polymers that will make and things that will make suds and will make microchip surfaces and all these things. And there's a jar of hand lotion on her desk, and she looked at it and she said, you know, I don't know what all these things are or why they're there. So it's really hard. I've come around to sort of thinking the more ingredients there are on a product, if it's a personal care product, the less I'm inclined to use it. There are a whole bunch of things that I now know I would like to avoid, and mostly they're not there so much anymore. The phthalates, which are the plasticizers that make PVC flexible, if you didn't put plasticizers into that polyvinyl chloride base, it would have the consistency of a saltine. It wouldn't be really useful. So we put these other chemicals in and they make them bendable. But they're also used in artificial fragrances. They're used as preservatives in all sorts of personal care products. So mostly because Europe has regulated those ahead of us, those have started to move on out. So you avoid those things, but it's really not perfect. It's really, really hard. And again, those strategic choices is kind of the way to go. Avoiding hot food and plastic. Really careful what you're exposing children to. I can't afford to rip up the carpet in my house. I'd really like to, but so there are a lot of choices that you can make. And as I said, I don't think we can entirely shop our way out of this, but and the market has started to move. All of the major baby bottle manufacturers in this country are now producing bottles that are not made out of polycarbonate. The big but is, thanks to how we regulate chemicals, we don't exactly know what's in those other ones. We know it's not polycarbonate, and so it doesn't have bisphenol A, but try as I couldn't find out, nor can any of the NGO folks who are completely devoted to this 7 days a week, have they been able to find out. So we have a long way to go to get those kind of disclosures. So partial answer to a huge question.
Thank you. I'm Jody Spear from Harborside. I'm glad you're talking about the efforts that are being made to replace the bad plastics with something that green chemists are finding can be replacements. But there's a caution that I think many of them have not come to terms with. I've been very supportive of the efforts in Maine to reduce the amount of endocrine disrupting chemicals. And at the same time, the same group of people are involved in trying to make plastics out of potatoes.
Yeah.
Genetic modification of crops is not coexistent with organic farming.
Yeah.
And this is something that even the Biomaterials Collaborative, the sustainable guidelines people are not confronting.
And
I'm looking for ways to find to make the people who are doing this new green chemistry acknowledge that they can do them from genetically modified.
Right. And I think the point you raise reminds me of something that I really, really wanted to mention that is another thing that would seem like is absolutely logical but is completely novel with some of the efforts in green chemistry is that the people who are working on new materials, like trying to make new bio-based materials or trying to make bioremediation products like Terry Collins' group is at Carnegie Mellon, that they are now starting to work, team up very specifically from the start with environmental health sciences. Terry Collins' group is working with Bruce Blumberg's group at UC Irvine, which has been doing some pioneering work into endocrine disruption science. And so when the group at Carnegie Mellon is working on making synthetic enzymes that can literally eat up contaminants like PCBs, that when they put these into aquatic environments, they're not going to be doing the things that Bruce Blumberg's group has discovered that the traditional antifoulant agents had been doing to snails and fish. So considerations like genetic modification, like the impacts of using plant material, how we grow plants, looking at the whole life cycle, because in addition to looking at environmental impacts as a sort of holistic picture, an entire environmental profile, green chemistry advocates resource efficiency in the actual synthesis of materials, but also looks at energy and water use, again, looking at the whole footprint. And it's not like organic standards. It's not a set of principles with a checklist. It's not like LEED certification. It's a set of principles. And one of the things that is implicit in it is to look at the whole picture and the whole profile. And so ideally, one of the things that would happen is that as this group who's looking at potatoes as a bio base gets a little further, as they're developing their work, they will be taking these things into consideration and not creating something that is going to have an even larger impact and that will help us get away from a phrase that I heard today in context with a report on the oil spill, unintended consequences. I think there are an awful lot of things, including the list of effects that you just read off of genetically modified foods or crops, that we can no longer say are unintended consequences. We know those consequences can happen. And personally, I think it's just a failure of imagination and a failure to really think the whole equation through, as we're seeing in the Gulf, that these kind of things happen. And again, we can't guarantee this, but part of the idea is to incorporate the full spectrum of what we know can happen environmentally as we move ahead with new materials. So I don't have a perfect answer for you, but that's part of the thinking around it. And I realize people have been sitting for quite some time, so do we have time for one more question?
Let's take one more.
Yeah.
The 90% in your list there of the synthetic chemicals or petrochemicals, and you're talking about the Gulf, and are you going to connect the work that the Senate today did in not passing the Murkowski Amendment in any work that you are going to write about? This is good news. This is good news because the Murkowski Amendment was going to ban the EPA from being able to regulate greenhouse gases.
Right.
greenhouse gases come from fossil fuels, right. Fossil fuels, da-da-da-da-da-da. So are you going to write about the all these things that connect?
Well, that's what I realized very early on as I started looking into the history of these materials, and when I was realizing, or I started to learn about the various effects that both climate change was having, and these things are inextricably linked. And so I realized really early on that climate change, greenhouse gases, the materials that are contributing to that, that's the backstory to the materials problems we have. And that's one of the things that makes it such a challenge. But, I mean, on one hand, it seemed like it was too easy to even be an important point. Well, how come we hadn't thought of that before? But it turns out so many of the things that are now happening, particularly to wildlife in the Arctic, are happening in tandem because of both the chemical exposures and impacts and because of climate change.
I want to thank our speaker for a wonderful lecture on a very, very obviously complex and difficult topic. This is really tough stuff, okay? Let's thank Elizabeth.
You've been listening to noted journalist Elizabeth Grossman, who spoke recently at the Marine Environmental Research Institute in Blue Hill on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can find it online at mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.